From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Last spring, a musical called Passing Strange opened off-Broadway to rave reviews. It's written and performed by an indie rock musician who goes by one name, Stu. The show is a hybrid of a rock concert and a traditional musical. Now it's traveled a couple of miles uptown from the Public Theater to the Belasco for its Broadway debut. Jeff London has the story of Passing Strange.
Stu, whose real name is Mark Stewart, calls himself a rock and roll lifer. With his band The Negro Problem, he's toured around the world putting out albums of what he calls Afro-Baroque cabaret music. And the Public Theater was so intrigued by his songs that they commissioned him 4 years ago to write a musical. Stu didn't know what the subject matter was going to be. He didn't know how the story would be told, but he knew how he wanted it to sound.
Everything's
we knew we were going to invent something because we kind of knew this hadn't been done before. The goal being to bring the actual music that one hears in a club to the stage, not through some kind of theatrical musical theater filter. You know, rock musical, that term, rock should really be in quotations, right? Because it's not really rock music that anyone who likes rock music would actually listen to.
Stu wrote the show with Heidi Rodewald, his bass-playing producer and ex-girlfriend. She says the two of them, along with director Annie Dorson, began working on Passing Strange by sitting in a room talking.
It was as if we just played a show and we're hanging around and Stu's just telling stories. It was pretty nice getting paid to do that.
What emerged from the process, Stu says, is a semi-autobiographical musical. It charts the journey of a character, known only as Youth, from his middle-class adolescence in L.A., to sex and drugs in Amsterdam, to the tumultuous days in the Berlin arts world before the wall fell.
It's what I like to call autobiographical fiction, in that every single thing that's happening on the stage, I can point to something in my life, some kind of corollary, you know, that corresponds in some way. But was I in Europe when my mom died? No. Did the things that happened in Amsterdam in our play happen to me? Some of them, but not all.
It's your first time.
Does it show I'm like an ice cube gone to melt?
I hope you find yourself at home.
I like the cards that I've been dealt.
And how's your mind?
Oh, it's blown. It's a vibe I've never felt.
Welcome to Amsterdam, Amsterdam.
It's really just about the costs of being a young artist. It's a 46-year-old guy looking back at the things that he did and the values he had in his 20s, sort of when you're making that decision to really be an artist, you know.
Now if you think you're dreaming, pinch yourself and look around. Miracles are commonplace when you're on holy ground.
Some worship our hoes, some kneel before our hash.
Some pray to our Van Goghs, all yours for a little cash only.
Stu is on stage the whole time with his band and with six actors who play multiple roles. If the piece is about a young artist trying to find himself, find his real self, the same is true of the staging.
I'm not a fictional person on stage. I am myself. I am Stu. I call myself narrator because it's just boring to hear Stu all the time, you know, and to read it. So a narrator's fun because I'm narrating. I am, you know, it's a fun thing. But I am my real self, and the band is real as well, you know. And I think we even try to let you know from all the mask changing, I mean the real mask, human mask changing, not costumes, that even the actors are real.
Now in Beverly Hills they gave him chills, and South Central put his soul in the deep freeze. But she gave him her keys.
Director Annie Dorson suggested the title, Passing Strange, from a line in Shakespeare's Othello, a play in which a black man navigates in a white world. Othello, speaking of wooing his wife Desdemona, says, "She gave me for my pains a world of sighs. She swore in faith 'twas strange, 'twas passing strange."
The resonances of it obviously go far beyond the original source, and there's a lot of discussion in the piece about passing and what that means. Time passing, passing for black, passing for white. Passing for black is actually, I say that like it's a common idea, but of course it is not a common idea. Passing for white is the common idea, and in this piece it's turned on its head.
In Passing Strange, the character of the youth adopts a streetwise persona to impress his fellow artists in Berlin.
He sees that he can play on being black. He can play on the same stereotypes that he was trying to avoid back home. He can actually play on those and manipulate them and use those stereotypes to his advantage in Europe.
Do you know what it's like to be the object of oppression, living under police occupation in the ghetto?
He did not. His police-occupied ghetto looked more like...
Your friend Terry stopped by again in that brand-new Datsun 240Z. Now, he's making good money, and he's not even in a gang.
Well, let me ask you this, Mr. Know-It-All. Do you know what it's like to hustle for dimes on the mean streets of South Central?
Nobody in this play knows what it's like to hustle for dimes on the mean streets of South Central.
Along the way, the youth tries on a lot of different masks while looking for his true self. Director Annie Dorson says the youth would rather write a song about loving the girl than actually love the girl.
In every one of those crossroads, he chooses art. And he chooses art thinking that he's choosing life, you know, because as Stu later says, some of us feel like art is more real than life.
Too bad it takes so long to see. Construct. It's the raw nerve's private zone. It's a personal sunset. You drive off into alone.
Actor Daniel Breaker, who plays the youth, thinks Stu's coming-of-age story has universal audience appeal.
Which is a big surprise to see a mix of not just race, but also age and economic background, which is very exciting to see a big mix of people coming to see the show, and I think we want to put them all together. Put this Benetton ad of audience members together and have a rock show, you know.
Passing Strange opens tonight. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
You can hear some of Stu's songs from Passing Strange at npr.org/music. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Since its birth in the late 1940s, bluegrass has evolved in ways that its founding father, Bill Monroe, could never have imagined. For more than a decade, mandolinist Chris Thiele has been in the vanguard of that change as a soloist and as a member of the popular acoustic pop band Nickel Creek. Now, Thiele has composed the most ambitious work of his career. It's a four-movement, 40-minute suite for bluegrass instruments. We get the story from Craig Havokhurst of member station WPLN in Nashville.
It owes a debt to Bach and Bob Dylan and even the Beach Boys. It's part modern chamber music and part song cycle, an impressionistic picture of a young marriage gone sour, called The Blind Leaving the Blind.
Walk me home, we'll watch the sun come up. Don't leave me alone, 'cause I've been left enough, it's over. I'll get over it.
Chris Thiele started writing the work about the time he moved from Nashville to New York in 2005.
After I got divorced, all of a sudden I had a lot of pent-up energy and lots of stuff that had gone into trying to make this failing relationship work that all of a sudden got kind of reapplied.
Thiele was a mandolin prodigy from Southern California who made his first solo album when he was 13. His heroes were the pioneers of progressive bluegrass, banjo player Bela Fleck and bassist Edgar Meyer were among the older musicians who mentored and collaborated with Thiele as he developed into a widely admired virtuoso. But only after he assembled a group of like-minded musicians from his own peer group was he able to focus his emotions and ideas into a long-form composition.
The real work started getting done when I knew that I had a group of buddies who could actually play it with me.
The band includes a fiddle player who used to sport a mohawk named Gabe Witcher, acoustic guitarist Chris Eldridge, son of a star bluegrass banjo player, jazz-trained bassist Greg Garrison, and banjo player Noam Pikelny.
When I first received the score and saw what Chris was asking for me to play on my instrument, I that had to have been just as traumatic as him getting his divorce papers. So we were all right there behind him.
Pikelny says the piece forced him to rethink what was possible on his instrument.
He figured, hey, if you have the notes there, you'll figure out a way to play it.
The first time we tried to play the first movement, it sounded pretty awful.
Bassist Greg Garrison had worked with Pikelny and the eclectic jam band Leftover Salmon, but he was just getting to know the other musicians when they first gathered in New York to rehearse.
We were literally in Chris's tiny little one-bedroom apartment in the East Village with suitcases and air mattresses scattered everywhere, and we somehow found enough room to set up our instruments and play.
As they chipped away at the piece over months of rehearsals, the group also worked up a batch of more conventional songs and released an album in 2006. They tried out several different band names, eventually settling on Punch Brothers from a Mark Twain short story. The Blind Leaving the Blind had its official world premiere at Carnegie Hall's 600-seat recital space, Zankel Hall, last March, as part of a series curated by composer John Adams. But the band also booked 3 nights last year to workshop the piece in front of the discriminating bluegrass and acoustic music audience at Nashville's Station Inn. An unusual journey, but one Thiele says suits the work.
Even though the result is something that's maybe hard to put a label on, it comes from bluegrass. You know, and all of us grew up with bluegrass to a certain extent, and we're really comfortable with that music, and it informs everything that we play and that we think about.
Hard to label is exactly what dobro player Jerry Douglas thought when he heard the piece for the first time. He's one of the founding fathers of progressive bluegrass, but he says what Punch Brothers are doing is even more complex and cerebral.
Sometimes I felt like I was working a crossword puzzle, emotionally wrung out at the end of some part of it because I'd concentrated so hard.
And he says for that reason, it won't be warmly received by some traditional bluegrass fans. On the other hand,
the musician in me marveled at how well it all went together and how it kept my attention the whole way, and I just thought it was an amazing thing for somebody to do.
There were risks involved for the musicians who left steady work to support Chris Thiele's vision, but banjo player Noam Pikelny says the chance to do something entirely new was too compelling to pass up.
We are definitely not the same musicians today that we were the day of that first impromptu jam session, and I think that required some kind of faith on Chris's part as far as how we would grow individually as an ensemble. And I think when everyone found out how well we got along and how the music clicked, it was just like, it was obvious that this is where everything has been heading.
That ensemble became part of Thiele's post-divorce support group. He even wrote his friends into the end of the suite, conjuring a picture of the five of them on a night after an early rehearsal, sitting in the 11th Street bar in Manhattan, drinking scotch, and trying to come up with band names.
Heaven shines through those stars, these city lights and the nearest bar.
I'll be with my friends hiding from the bitter end. It's sort of a depressed happy, but a happy nonetheless. And I thought that, you know, sitting there in the bar with the boys, having just worked really hard, making some music together, and then kicking back afterwards, you know, it's kind of what life is all about, really.
Having your friends there to support you, personally and musically. For NPR News, I'm Craig Havighurst in Nashville.
You can hear entire songs from the Punch Brothers' new album at npr.org/music. Wilson Pickett, Muddy Waters, Carlos Santana, and Jimi Hendrix have in common. Buddy Miles kept beat for them all. The drummer died Tuesday at the age of 60.
On stage, Buddy Miles was a force to be reckoned with the hands of a drummer, but the heart and showmanship of a frontman. He played briefly with Hendrix in the trio Band of Gypsies. When soloing, even with Hendrix, he commanded the stage, using every cymbal, every drum, even his voice.
A run of criminal behavior landed Miles in San Quentin State Prison, but he eventually returned to the spotlight in the late 80s as a claymation California raisin.
He was the voice of Buddy Raisin in a string of popular commercials and spin-off albums. Instead of drumming, Buddy Miles was finally the frontman, singing his heart out.
And our last word in business today, Rolling Stone India. It hit newsstands this week in Mumbai, Kolkata, and other cities. The new edition of the U.S. music magazine will focus on international stars like Radiohead and Led Zeppelin, and also Bollywood soundtracks. They make up 70% of the music sales in India. The new magazine will also be priced at a competitive 100 rupees, or $2.50. Fans once had to pay five times that much for the imported U.S. edition of Rolling Stone. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
If your band is heavily influenced by this, then how in the world do you end up sounding like this?
Soul of a woman was created for love.
70s British band Led Zeppelin laid the foundation for an explosive style of rock and roll called heavy metal. But the rock superstars would have been nothing without American blues. Guitarist Jimmy Page closely studied blues greats like Muddy Waters, Robert Johnson, and Leadbelly. Sometimes their influence on Zeppelin's music was subtle, and sometimes it was right in your face.
Working from seven to 11 here and there.
It's been 40 years since the members of Led Zeppelin started making rock together. Ever since the group's reunion show last fall, rumors have been swirling about an international tour. As fans chew on that, we wanted to know more about the blues music at the heart of Zeppelin's massive rock sound. Joining me now is Stephen Davis, author of Hammer of the Gods, the Led Zeppelin Saga. Welcome.
Thank you.
So first, give me some context. It's the mid-1960s in England. The Beatles are all over the place. How did these four guys who formed Led Zeppelin get exposed to the blues?
Well,
Led Zeppelin is descended from one of the original London beat groups, the Yardbirds, who formed right after the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. The difference was that when American blues stars would come to London, they were backed up. They needed backing bands, and it was usually the Yardbirds who backed them up. And so Jimmy Page, Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, these great guitarists from the Yardbirds, all were sort of mentored by these geniuses from coming through from Chicago, Howling Wolf, Sonny Boy Williamson, Muddy Waters. They backed them up and made records with them. So when it was time a few years later to form Led Zeppelin, Jimmy Page was in a hurry for material. They didn't have time to write a lot of new material, so they decided to appropriate, as it were, a lot of old blues songs and take credit for them. And that's pretty much the first two Led Zeppelin albums.
Let's listen to a little bit of the song, You Shook Me.
You know you shook me. You shook me all night long.
Why did that song end up on their first album? What made it sing for them?
Well, as I said, they needed material quick, and they decided to use a lot of blues songs with which they were very familiar because they were blues scholars. But they couldn't do them as blues songs because in 1968, the psychedelic movement was at its height, and they wanted to make a sort of an atomic blues. And that's where Led Zeppelin and these very heavy blues acts come from. They're trying to make a blues-based music for the nuclear age, as it were. And so you have this incredible reserve and very heavy four-to-the-floor drumming and it was bombs away with the blues, more or less.
Explain to me how you would describe the guitar in that cut.
Yeah, well, it's a psychedelic blues guitar. It instead of sounding like the human voice, which is what a blues guitar wants to do, it sounds instead like a siren. You have to remember that Jimi Hendrix was at the same time improvising on blues changes, and this was Led Zeppelin's competition and inspiration in many ways.
Now, a lot of times there's talk about blues being just one of many African-American inspired or generated musical idioms. And rock and roll is considered another one of those. So when you say blending blues and rock, just explain where one stops and the other begins.
Well, blues, to my way of thinking, there's country blues, which sort of stops at the end of World War II. That begat rhythm and blues. And rock and roll came along and was the music of young Southern whites, but obviously deeply indebted to R&B, rhythm and blues. And, You Shook Me. Well, that was written by Willie Dixon in Chicago and sung by J.B. Lenoir. But when it came out on the first Led Zeppelin album, I think was credited either to Jimmy Page and Robert Plant or to Led Zeppelin. And the problem many people had with Led Zeppelin was that it took too long to credit the people who actually wrote these songs. And in Willie Dixon's case, he didn't receive any royalties on any of the many songs that Led Zeppelin copied for 20 years or so.
Let's go through a little bit more of this series of influence. One of Zeppelin's most popular songs based on the blues is called When the Levee Breaks. Let's hear the original 1929 version of the song by Kansas Joe McCoy and Memphis Minnie.
Levee keeps on raining, levee's going to break. Levee keeps on raining, levee's going to break.
And here is the song Zeppelinized. So how do you get from point A to point B?
Well, again, it's bombs away with Led Zeppelin. You have this delicate, filigreed Memphis Mini guitar lick and from 1929. And let's see, 42 years later, they unchain Led Zeppelin's drummer, John Bonham. And what happens? It's blues for the atomic age. It's a psychedelic reconfiguration of, you know, a simple Delta blues.
If it keeps on raining, let me score.
Now let's look at listen to another tune that you say is a good example. It's called Whole Lotta Love. I think a lot of folks are going to know that. So it's based on the Muddy Waters tune, You Need Love. Here's Muddy's song.
You got yawning and I got funny. Baby, you look so sweet and cunning.
And here's Led Zeppelin's translation.
You need cool air. Baby, I'm not.
So tell us, what about this song is blues or blues-like, and what is rock?
You Need Love was originally written by Willie Dixon and sung by Muddy Waters. And Led Zeppelin takes this Muddy Waters old blues and adds some cannon fire, some explosive, just incredible singing and this repetitive riff, and turns it into this very hypnotic heavy metal anthem. Probably one of the most exciting things that the band ever did. And when you looked at the credits on Led Zeppelin II, sure enough, you know, the composer's credits were Jimmy Page and Robert Plant and the other two guys in Led Zeppelin. So, again, it took Willie Dixon years and years and many lawsuits. And remember, these Led Zeppelin, at the time these records came out, were ruled the booming record industry of the 1970s as its biggest act. Millions and millions of dollars were made off these songs, and the composers saw nothing until they had to sue much, much later.
Thanks a lot, Stephen.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Stephen Davis is author of Hammer of the Gods, The Led Zeppelin Saga. An updated fourth edition of the book comes out in April, and he joined me from the studios of WGBH in Boston.